The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us this morning as certified financial planner Jim Solnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
On today's show, we are going to discuss some common IRA tax issues, those mistakes, whether made by you individually or sometimes by tax professionals, those common mistakes that can cause you nightmares with tax issues with your IRA. Thanks for joining us. This is the Retirement IRA Show. My name is Chris Stein. I'm here with Jim Solnier as well. Good afternoon, Jim.
Hello.
Jim's microphone, I don't believe, is on. Or
hello.
Oh, there. His mouth was just
I wasn't
too far
talking into
the,
it. Now I'm looking at it. You know me, I multitask.
Yeah, no problem. So today's Saturday, of course, if you're listening to this live. This is Saturday, June 11th. We are pre-recording this on, what is today? June 8th, actually. We're doing kind of an odd Wednesday recording. We usually record these on Tuesday. This afternoon, a little cloudy here for us. Hopefully Saturday's going to be beautiful. I think I'm going to be doing a little camping on Saturday. And because it's a pre-recorded show, of course, no live calls.
We got so many last time.
Yeah, even when we're live, nobody calls. So wouldn't it be strange if people called
today?
While we're
yeah,
not,
yeah,
not
exactly.
There. So we're not live today, so we're not going to answer any live questions. We may or may not. Jim is usually the holder of all emails, so I don't know. I haven't heard yet if we have any emails from this past week.
We do not.
We do not. Okay, so silence. Are you sure our phones and emails work?
I've been receiving plenty of spam mail, so
okay,
it's working.
But we figured we'd talk a little bit about some very common mistakes, not to ridicule people, but to make people aware of the pitfalls, the potholes, whatever you might call them, that can occur if you inadvertently or even on purpose violate certain tax rules in regards to IRAs. And one of the reasons why we started this show in the first place is that accounts like IRAs and 401ks and 457s and TSPs are a lot more complicated and involved with rules than people really understand. They seem like simple little things, but when it gets down to it, it's really easy to make some mistakes, and it's the IRS that comes knocking when you make such mistakes. So, Jim, I think you're the holder of the list. Unless you have something else to chat about, we can...
Negative. I was actually trying to look something else up, but I will do it purely from memory.
Uh-oh.
what does that mean?
I don't know. It sounds a little risky.
It could be risky, but perhaps I will find it later. I know it's in this book I'm looking for, but we will begin again with... I'm not used to jumping into the show so quickly.
Oh, usually, would you like to talk about some other things?
Well, usually you banter for hours, and then we get into the show.
Hours? That's usually Pete when he's here. Things are a lot more efficient now that Pete's not here.
Oh, so you're blaming Pete.
Yeah, well, he's the one who's not here, so.
He should hopefully be in sometime this month. I know in July he is gone for a couple of weeks, and then in August he's gone. He told me the day we were driving in when you weren't there, he said he's considering this his practice retirement. Mm. So Mrs. Pete is dragging him around.
For a month?
To different places,
see what
yeah.
See how it's going to work?
Well, you know, they're going to be together more often doing retired stuff.
Well, hopefully he discovers that he enjoys that.
Well, I'm sure he does. So I forget where they're going, they told me, but they're driving. I think they're going to Missouri. Yeah, he was laughing because he's going to Missouri, or Missouri, I forget which way he calls it, in July.
That doesn't sound fun
at
all.
No, he says it's going to be hot.
It's going to be hot and humid and yeah. Bugs and...
So they're driving there, and then in August, they're going somewhere else. So anyways, he'll be in and out. He'll be popping in and out. I can't say for sure when he'll be on next. I'd like to get him on in June, maybe even next week, because I may not be able to go live next week. So next week may be a recorded show as well. In fact, I can pretty much tell you I won't be live next week.
So maybe we can get him in for some estate planning questions.
If he can go live on Saturday, if not... we can do a pre-recorded show and with him maybe and play it on Saturday.
Okay. That being said, so when you listen to this, if you have any estate planning questions, this would be a good time to send those in, jim@jimhelps.com. So if you have any questions about revocable living trusts, about wills, about probate, about how a person's estate is handled, about how to protect assets, certain kinds of assets, whether they be real estate or other personal assets, he's kind of the guy, so we bring him in for his wisdom in regards to all things estate planning.
Okay. So let's get to something I wanted to cover. We covered this.
Is this a top 10 list?
No. Oh. There's 10 in here, but we're not going to go over 10 to 5. Some of these are just going to confuse the heck out of our listeners, and I don't want to do that.
10's too many.
And 10 would take you too long because yeah. You just go on and on and on, and sometimes it gets annoying, but I just sit here and listen. Okay.
I'm glad you're so so accepting of me.
Okay. I found what I was looking for, too. Perfect. Look at that. Okay. See, and I put notes on that page.
You did. Maybe you should put one of those little colorful flags.
You got to put a little sticky thing mm-hmm. on there, yeah. Or scan this page. But okay, I found what I wanted. All right. What we did, one of the things we went over when I was in the EdSlot program, when I was in Atlanta in May. You remember at the beginning of May I went to Atlanta?
Mm-hmm. I do remember.
Okay. One of the things was some common tax mistakes that people make. And I wouldn't necessarily say tax mistakes. Common mistakes tax preparers, he said, make with IRAs. And Ed was saying that these are mistakes that he sees quite often being made by tax preparers, mm-hmm. CPAs, enrolled agents, or just Joe Blow down the block. With IRAs, common mistakes that they make. And he was just pointing them out to us, and I thought, you know, some of these would make really good banter or fodder, however you want to word it, on the radio show. And one of the thoughts that I had is we'll go over not all 10, because some of them get very involved with net unrealized appreciation and net operating losses and Roth conversions, get into very high levels of discussion mm-hmm. where we would lose a lot of listeners. They fall asleep.
Probably lose me too.
And probably lose you as well. We don't want to do that. So these are just common mistakes. So we're going to go over as many as we can before we run out of showtime. And I will opine and please add in anything that you can add in. But hopefully our listeners will learn a little bit something about IRAs. We haven't talked about IRAs for a while. We've been kind of concentrating a lot of topics we covered were Social Security, qualified longevity annuity contracts, annuity payments, longevity protection. Retirement planning in general, and we forgot the IRA part of the retirement and IRA show.
So we're going back. So we're back to our roots.
We're swinging it around back into IRAs and some simple common mistakes that are often made. And the first one that he wanted to point out, and we're going to also share with our listeners something that Natalie Choate, is it Choate or Choate?
It's Choate.
Choate, right? Mm-hmm. Choate. For those who don't know who Ed and Natalie are, Ed Slott is one of the preeminent IRA experts in the nation. He's highly regarded. He's quoted. You Google his name. The guy's been quoted everywhere. And he also has the program that I study in. I'm in his study group. I've been studying with Ed now, I can't remember if it's 6 or 7 years, but quite oh, wow. some time, quite mm-hmm. some time. Might even be 9 years. No, I'm in group nine. Hmm. I'm in group nine, but I think I've been in the program for 7 or 8 years. But nonetheless, I study under Ed a lot of these topics that relate to not only IRAs, he's really branched out, any type of retirement account, and now he's getting into more advice too on generalized retirement planning. We talked about on last week's live show some of the findings that reporters and researchers have been asking him, he's sharing with us. A lot of them that surprised us, because they should ask us, because we've been, if you remember last week's show, mm-hmm. How that went. Okay. The other preeminent expert out there, one of the other experts, is a woman named Natalie Choate. Mm-hmm. She's in Boston. She lives in Boston.
And I believe she's an attorney.
She is an attorney.
She comes from an attorney standpoint. Ed Slott is a tax guy.
He's a CPA.
He's a CPA. So two different backgrounds, but they do a lot of work commonly in retirement account issues.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to share with our listeners. Ed doesn't get into this. The first topic we're going to cover is problems with Form 5329. And before you all gloss over and shut the radio off, or if you're on iTunes thinking, oh, this is going to be boring, trust me, you're going to learn a lot. Natalie has a unique way of removing problems with Form 5329. And I think you remember what her suggestion mm-hmm. is, because you're nodding your head. And she says she does this with her own tax return every year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not a tax expert. We are bringing tax planning in-house next year. I'm pleased to let our listeners know. Justin, who is in our office, is diligently studying the enrolled agent exam. That is an exam given by the IRS to people who want to do personal income taxes. And Justin is in that study group. And he will be joining us more and more on the show in the future, people, to give us tax insight. We have found, Chris and I have found, as we work with clients and we start projecting their retirement, one of the things that we constantly ran into is we would be looking 10, 15, 20 years into the future and seeing tax nightmares with required minimum distributions, taxation of Social Security, pushing people into higher Medicare in brackets. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't know now, Medicare premiums are means-tested, people. This may come as a shock to you. They are now means-tested based on income, not based on assets. And if your income is above certain levels, you will pay more in Medicare premiums. That silently passed several years ago. Those brackets that they peg your income to are not adjusted for inflation. We've talked about this before, Chris. And people who might be in their 40s and 50s today thinking, oh, no problem, you're probably going to pay a lot more in Medicare premiums than you imagine when you turn 65 in another 15, 20, 25 years. And if you do some proactive tax planning, you might be able to reduce that. It's because of these issues we wanted to bring tax planning in-house. Now, again, right now we're not tax experts, but when someone like Natalie Choate says, this is what I do, and this is what you may want to consider doing, I know when we start doing tax returns, I'm going to encourage Justin to do the exact same thing Natalie is doing.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't talked to him about that yet, but I'll hit him with it later. So let's get into Form 5329 and what I'm talking about and why Ed says this is an area where people tend to make mistakes. Form 5329 has a interesting title. It says additional taxes owed on qualified plans, including IRAs and other tax-favored accounts. That's the name of the form.
It's a long title.
You figure they'd come up with an acronym
for
that.
Yeah, you think that, maybe. That's a long one. That'd be a tough one. They sent it to the Department of Acronyms, and they just pushed it back and said, too complicated.
Yeah, but so that's the name of the IRS form. It is the form for additional taxes on qualified plans, including IRAs and other tax-favored accounts. What is unique on 5329?
It's the only extra form that requires a signature at the bottom, like your 1040 does. Your 1040, of course, requires a signature, but all the other addendums and things you put with it and all the other schedules that go with that 1040 in support of that tax document rely on the signature on the 1040. Form 5329 has its own signature line. Why is this important, Jim?
Because tax courts and the IRS, not just the IRS, tax courts, when you want to complain and fight the IRS, you go to tax court. The IRS and the tax courts have ruled consistently because Form 5329 requires its own standalone signature. There is no statute of limitations on Form 5329 until one is actually filed. A lot of people think, hey, I did my taxes. I put too much money into my IRA. They're never going to catch it. And if they don't catch me in 3 years, statute of limitations. And they leave extra money in their IRA. People do this all the time, either knowingly or unknowingly. Uh-oh, I knew I was staying that.
No,
you're
keep
right.
Going.
Did I say statute wrong? Is it statute or statute?
Statute.
What do I say, statue?
Well, you said statue twice. I wasn't going to point it out. I was going to write you a little note. Yeah. You want to bring it up? Yeah. Statue is like the Statue of Liberty.
Okay, so this statute is a statute.
Is a legal
This is like
document.
Trying to say statue, but sneezing in the middle. Statue.
Kind of, yes. So the statute of limitations, if the IRS doesn't catch you within 3 years, in most cases, you are free and clear. They can't come back at you. So this with this line on here, if you don't sign this form in addition to your 1040 and send it in, they can come after you for issues that are on this form basically forever.
Not basically. It is.
Forever.
Forever.
Right.
And that's the issue, people. When you make mistakes with your IRA or other tax-qualified accounts, that would be your 401k, for federal government employees, your TSP, if you're a school employee, your 403b, if you're a nonprofit or governmental, your 457 plan, all these plans you would use this form for. This little form with a very, very concise title, the shortest title I've ever seen. Being a little facetious there. Form 5329, the additional taxes on qualified plans, including IRAs and other tax-favored accounts. That's the form, people, you use to report and pay the 6% penalty, 10% penalty, or 50% penalty your mistake is going to cost. And we can get into later whether the 6% is, the 10%, or the 50%. But if you make a mistake with a retirement account, you have to file this form. So many people think, all's what I've got to do is file my 1040, wait 3 years, and boom, that missed required minimum distribution I was supposed to take goes away. IRS didn't catch me. They only have 3 years to catch my mistake. No, they don't, people. They have forever. Because the courts have ruled you didn't file Form 5329, and that is a standalone legal tax document, and that is the document where you report the mistake you made. You didn't report the mistake you made on your Form 1040. You reported on 5329.
And the interesting part is, what if you don't believe you have made a mistake?
That's where you get nailed.
Most people then don't file 5329 because they're thinking, well, I did everything correctly. I don't need to report a mistake. I didn't make a mistake. Natalie Choate's advice is to go ahead and file it, claiming no mistakes, sign it and date it. By sending it in, what does that do? Starts the three-year clock.
Exactly.
So they truly then do only have 3 years to catch a mistake that you may have accidentally done. You fully believe that you didn't make a mistake, but you file it anyway.
And that's what Ed is getting at. And he gave to us some examples, folks. I'm not going to get into them. But he gave some examples of a national CPA firm. I'm not going to mention the firm, mostly because Ed didn't tell us the name. But he told us about a national CPA firm that helped their clients contribute money to Roth IRAs.
Just a little too much.
Who were not allowed to contribute, and they put too much in. And that the clients of this firm were held liable for penalties on excess Roth contributions, late filing penalties, negligence penalties. They nailed these firms' clients to the tune of $120,000 for mistakes that were made that at the time they didn't know were mistakes. But if this national firm had done what Natalie suggests And what Chris just said, every year, especially if you're playing with an IRA, especially if you're a little unsure or you just don't know, but if you have a retirement account, Natalie said she does on her tax return every year, files form 5329, which is only 2 pages, long title, mm-hmm. 2 pages, and puts zeros in all the boxes mm-hmm. and signs it. Because she's telling the IRS, I didn't make any mistakes. I'm declaring it.
Mm-hmm. Now, what you have to watch out for, if you made a mistake and you know, but then you sign a document that says you didn't, that's tax fraud. So you're not going to get out of it that way. But if you truly don't think you made a mistake, the trap here is you honestly try to do your taxes properly, but you make an innocent mistake. It would be nice if you weren't penalized for that innocent mistake, and you won't be if you make it past the 3-year clock. But you must start the clock running by filing a zeroed out Form 5329.
Right, and you're simply telling the IRS, there's only 8 parts to this. So you, part one, tax on early distribution. Zero, I don't have one. Part two, tax on certain distributions from education savings accounts. Don't even have one of those. Zero. Part three, additional excise tax on an excess contribution. That's what nailed the clients on that other form. Zero, I don't have any, you write. Part four, additional tax on excess contributions to Roths. Zero. She just zeros every part out. Part five, part six, part seven, part eight for those over the age of 70 and a half. This is important for people over the age of 70 and a half. Part eight is where you report missed required minimum distributions. Zero. Didn't miss any. File it. Sign it.
In the other order.
Sign it, file it. And Natalie attaches that. That starts the 3-year statute. I thought it was chew.
Statute.
Oh, toot. Statute of limitations.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Nice.
So anyways, Ed wanted to point out that part with Form 5329. Very important form mm-hmm. and very important. Anybody out there who's might be doing something nefarious or something even questionable, you're not quite sure if this
maybe
can
you're
be
kind
done.
Of pushing the limits of what is allowed or something. You think it's allowed, but it is kind of a maybe you believe it's a gray area. Fill one of these out. They've only got 3 years then.
But again, as Chris said, it's not going to protect you from fraud. This isn't a get out of jail free card because fraud has no statute of limitations. Mm-hmm.
Now it's getting a little aggressive with the
We're going to get another email from that guy who doesn't like the way I talk.
Well, there's only one who's writing to you.
The one who said...
Maybe he represents a whole army of...
It's an awful, awful show.
It's terrible. We're doing damage.
Doing damage to my business and mm-hmm. apparently to the English language.
Apparently.
Well, again, I tell people, you don't listen to this to master the English language or even English grammar. You listen to this to learn about retirement planning.
Correct.
Okay.
It's a good way of looking at it.
All right. So hopefully people found that mm-hmm. interesting. I, again, am not a tax preparer or a tax expert. But how hard is it just to zero out a 5329, sign it, and attach it to your 1040? Again, that came from Natalie Choate, one of the best regarded or highest regarded and well-educated minds in tax planning, estate planning, and IRAs. She does this, she told us. I think you were at that class with her. Did you come with me to that one?
I've seen her talk about this since the beginning when she started. She started this 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, she's the one pushing this, mm-hmm. yeah. And it just is to protect you from a mistake you don't know. Remember, they can go back 3, 5, 8, 10, 12, 15 years from now unless you file this form. So you may think you're doing everything right. Doesn't hurt. Zero this out, file it, and you're good to go. Especially when you get to 70 and a half and RMDs begin. It is so easy to make a mistake with RMDs. Zero it out. Tell them you don't have any missed RMDs. File it. And they have 3 years to prove otherwise. Now, again, fraud, no. If you're abject yeah. committing fraud, this isn't a get-out-of-free-jail card. But it will protect you for an honest, simple mistake. Hey, I filed my Form 5329. You accepted it.
Perfect. So we are coming to the end of our first segment here. When we come back from this first break, we are going to hear a top song from 1935, which is the year Social Security started. This song was originally written in 1925 by a Danish composer, but became very popular after the Boston Pops, hey, a tie into Boston, Boston Pops performed their version in 1935. So we'll find out what that is right after this short break.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. That is one of the top musical hits, if you will. I wouldn't really call it a song. Musical hits from 1935, performed there by the Boston Pops Orchestra. Name of the tune is Jealousy, originally written by Danish composer Jakob Gade. And I'm not sure, G-A-D-E might be pronounced differently in Danish. I don't know. He intended it to be a tango without any vocals, but it has since been used both with and without vocals. It's been included in movies like Death on the Nile, an Agatha Christie mystery, Mel Brooks' silent movie in 1976. It's a very, very well-known tune. I think everybody's probably heard that at various times. But we look back to 1935 as the beginning of Social Security. We'll have an update on what's new with helpwithmysocialsecurity.com in a little bit. But now we're going to get back to common IRA tax issues or mistakes that are made. We dealt with Form 5329 in the last segment.
Yes.
We're on to a brand new segment, brand new topic.
Brand new topic, brand new mistake people often make. And remember, this is mistakes tax preparers make. First mistake, they're not filing Form 5329 for their clients, even with zeros. Second mistake, not quite advising clients correctly on the once per year IRA rollover rule.
Still a little confusing for people because it's changed.
It has changed. Changed in 2014. So it's been changed for a while. It's been changed for a while. But it still causes issues. Yeah. Prior to the change, prior to the Brabo case, Barbro. Prior to that case, very confusing case. But it's the only court order they actually downloaded and read. Remember, it's the first one I ever downloaded and read.
Really?
When the ruling came out, I was home on a Saturday when I read the ruling came out, and I downloaded the
actual ruling,
tax court ruling, and read it. Yeah, it was quite interesting.
Sounds like a horrific Saturday, if you ask me.
Well, it was huge in the industry because prior to this ruling, prior to this guy, the guy was, let's face it, he was trying to game the system. Mm-hmm. What we mean by a 60-day rollover, for those who don't know, it's when you take money from your IRA and you take it out. You just call up your IRA custodian and say, hey, give me $50,000 from my IRA, assuming you have $50,000 in there. Give me $50,000 from my IRA. They will write the check directly to you, people. $50,000, mail it to you. They don't care. It's your money. And no taxes, no penalties are owed on that money when you get it. So long as you put it back in an IRA within 60 days. 60 days when? 60 days from when you called them, 60 days from when they cut the check, 60 days from when you received the check. When is it 60 days from, Chris?
60 days from when you receive the check.
Exactly. That's one of the big things that confuses people. Mm-hmm. Where do you start counting the 60 days? Sometimes tax preparers erroneously make a mistake. And the mistake is the person says, oh, yeah, I called up I called up my IRA provider just pick a day. What is today? Today is June 7th.
8th.
8th. Isn't it? Well, it doesn't matter. Today is June 8th. Mm-hmm. And the tax preparer says, okay, so on June 8th is when you called up and requested this money. Yes. And they begin the time from June 8th. That's not when it comes. It's not when you called them And what if it was after the market closed on June 8th? And let's just say June 8th was a Friday. And they don't get till it till on Monday. And they don't actually mail the check until Tuesday. So we're already up to June 12th or 13th already. And then they mail it. And you don't receive it until July 15th.
Delay.
Yeah, we talk about the Christmas gift I mailed my father in November that he opened in April. Because it took them that long to send a package from Colorado to Massachusetts.
It's now, long ways.
CPAs might start counting from June 8th, though, the day you called them. Not July 15th, or whatever I said, July something, the day you got the check. It's the day you get the check, people. That's when the 60 days counts. Now, the key is Saturdays, Sundays, holidays, weekends, all those go into the 60-day count. And you have to get that money back into an IRA within 60 days. If you do that, no taxes, no penalties are owed. So sometimes tax preparers start counting from the wrong time period and making you pay taxes and penalties where none may have been due.
Right.
Now, if you had an electronic deposit, it's the day the money gets put into your checking account. That's constructive receipt. It doesn't matter if you didn't take the money out of the account right away. You received it. So we're only talking about cases where you request for actual paper check to be mailed to you. If you request that the money to be deposited electronically, it theoretically, depending on what time you call the custodian, could happen on the day you call. Could be that fast.
Could be.
So you have to remember, it's from when you receive the check or receive the money electronically that you start counting the 60 days. The other thing that, back to the Barbro case and what confused people and caused a big consternation in my industry back in 2014, when the tax court ruled this, the prior position of the IRS was you were allowed to do one 60-day IRA rollover per IRA per 365-day period. So if you had five IRAs, you could do five rollovers, which is what Barbro was trying to do. Mm-hmm. Him and his wife had multiple IRAs. They were trying to take money out for 60 days, use it to cover some expenses they had. They were really living very tightly with a lot of debt, a lot of issues going on. They couldn't make the cash flow, so they took a little bit of money out, tried to get it back in within 60 days, started taking money out of another IRA, tried to spend that, and eventually the IRS caught them. Well, the IRS lost the case. I won't bore you with the whole case. Yet they won the case. They won when they lost. Because the tax court ruled, no. You all have been doing this wrong for decades.
Mm-hmm.
It's not one per IRA per taxpayer. It's one per taxpayer. And that was a huge ruling. So Barbro lost. The IRS lost on the original case they took the guy to court on, but the tax court came back with a much better ruling for them. They weren't even taking them to court on the multiple rollovers. They had no problem with that. They had problem on other things. Tax court said to the IRS, you lost on all those other things. Mr. Barbro, you won. He must have been psyched at that point. It's when the tax court followed with, but. Now, that was definitely a Sir Mix-a-Lot moment, I bet. That but.
I like big butts and I cannot lie.
Okay, for sure, after they told the IRS, you lose, Mr. Barbro, you win, he was probably excited, and then one of the judges probably said, but...
I like big butts, and I cannot lie. You other brothers can't deny.
Can't say it over and over again.
You're really getting into that. So when they followed with the but, they said, here's the rule, though. Our interpretation of what Congress wrote is it's one per IRA per taxpayer. So, Mr. Barbro, you did three. Your last two were not allowed, and that's what they got him on. And that was huge in our industry. So today, we still run into issues on that. What are the issues? First, the one that I just explained to you. When do you start counting the 60 days? Second, all IRAs and Roth IRAs as counted as one. It's not one per IRA, one per Roth IRA. It's one. So if you do a rollover from a Roth and you have another personal IRA, non-Roth off to the side, doesn't matter. It's one per taxpayer for all your accounts together. And IRAs and Roth IRAs and SEP IRAs and simple IRAs, they're all counted as one, even though they're different account types. So that's another area where people make mistakes. But another area where people make mistakes on this 60-day rollover is, first of all, it is not calendar year, is it, Chris?
It's 365 days.
Exactly. It's not that, gee, I can do one December 30th, 2016, and January 3rd, 2017, it's a new year, I can do another one.
Nope.
No, you have to count out 365 days, not 364. Don't have to go as high as 366, but 365, whatever that falls on, counting leap years, weekends, business, holidays, doesn't matter. 365 days later, you can do one more rollover. So that part hopefully doesn't confuse people. Another part, though, that does get a lot of tax preparers is there are exemptions to the 60-day rollover. One per year rule. Did you know that? Of course you did, because we talked about this in the past.
There's always an exception to.
One of the exemptions is what Chris and I will probably start talking about diligently in another 4 months. What are we going to talk about in four more months? Do the math.
Today, we're in June. We're going to be heading for October. So October 15th is recharacterization day.
Recharacterization, but we're also in the fall. What is, in order to do a recharacterization, what must you have done first?
A conversion.
Exactly. Conversions need to be done by the end of the year.
Correct.
And one of the ways we do fast conversions is through a rollover.
Correct.
Rollovers for conversions are exempt.
Yep.
What does all that mean? Because people's brains are spinning. Conversions is where you take an existing IRA and turn it into a Roth IRA. Okay. So the IRS says if you take money from your IRA, you can take it as cash, do what you want with it, and as long as you put it in a Roth IRA within 60 days, we're going to consider that a conversion. It is not going to save you from income taxes, is it?
No, and this is why they don't mind letting you do this, because you are paying the taxes during this process. They're just essentially giving you an exemption for a limit on how much you can put in your Roth. They say, we're going to raise the limit and allow you to put this entire amount that came out of your IRA into the Roth.
It will exempt you from the 10% penalty.
Correct.
So one thing, and I'm not saying that this is a viable strategy, but if people are trying to get money out of their IRA and need it for a short-term loan and missed the... not missed, but within the 60 days, if you just took that money and put it in a Roth IRA, and this happens all the time, people, especially self-employed people who are waiting for a check to come in from maybe a realtor sold a house and they're waiting for the commission check to come in, or someone is just waiting for this check to come in and they got no money right now. They could theoretically take money from their IRA, and if it's their first rollover, take it, and within 60 days, when the commission check comes in, put it into the IRA. Mm-hmm. But what if they need to do it again? Things get tight later in the year. Well, it's not going to absolve you from taxation, but you could take the money from an IRA, even though you already did a rollover, take it again within, it doesn't matter if it's the very next day. You can, these are an exemption from the 60-day rollover rule. Take money from the IRA and just put it in a Roth IRA when you're done. Within 60 days. Mm-hmm. So hopefully you get your commission check and things are okay and you put that money in. I'm not advocating people do this because you can get really burned if you make a mistake. But conversions to a Roth are exempt because of the reason Chris just said. It's not going to absolve you of taxes. You're still going to have to pay taxes. It will save you if you're under the age of 59 and a half from the 10% penalty. So if you took $3,000 out of your IRA because you needed it and you're waiting for your commission check to come in, you get your commission check. Let's say it was $10,000, Chris. You could take $3,000 from that commission check and put it in a Roth as a conversion. You're still going to owe taxes, but you're going to owe taxes the other way too. Mm-hmm. What it will save you is if you were under the age of 59 and a half, the $300 penalty.
Yep.
Rollovers to a 401k are exempt. So here's where it could get really unique.
Yeah.
If You did. And again, if you're going to try all these, you're right up there with Barbro. You're trying to game the system. But rollovers to an IRA are exempt from the one
to a 401k.
To a 401k. Mm-hmm. From an IRA to a 401k. So again, you're that realtor. And
kind of picking on realtors today.
Well, it's just I'm not picking on them, but they live and breathe by what they sell. Mm-hmm. You eat what you kill, and if you're not killing, you're not eating. So if they're not selling houses, there's no money coming in. Or they might have sold a house and they're just waiting for the closing. And they know, oh God, the closing is in 2 weeks, but oh, my mortgage payment is due. They could get into those cash flow troubles. New realtors, an established realtor, I'm sure, is get the cash flow. Okay, so you've already done one rollover. Your mortgage payments are due. You could have your own solo 401k that accepts rollovers. Because you're an independent contractor, so the realtor runs out and creates their own solo 401k, which is perfectly legal. Mm-hmm. And when you open your 401k, you're given all these little check boxes. Do you want to allow this? Do you want to allow that? You check the little box that says you accept rollovers in.
Mm, good.
Now you have an IRA, and you have your little 401k. You take money out of your IRA and use it to cover your expenses. Hopefully, within 60 days, your commission check comes in. You take that money. Let's say, again, it was $3,000. You take $3,000 from your commission check, put it into your 401k. Rollovers from an IRA to a 401k are exempt from the one per taxpayer per year rule. Don't blow this, people. If you're trying this at home, you it's like juggling with knives while blindfolded, standing on one foot. Kind of dangerous. That's a pretty dangerous thing.
It is. I'm imagining it right now.
Juggling with knives, blindfolded, standing on one foot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It'd be pretty dangerous. Mm-hmm. But if you are going to do this, make sure the money goes into your solo 401k and not another IRA. If you've already done one within the last 365 days. But remember, rollovers for conversions, rollovers from an IRA to a 401k are exempt. And unlike the rollover to an a Roth IRA, rollover for conversion, we call it, this one would not be subject to taxes and a 10% penalty. If you take money from an IRA and within 60 days put it into a 401k, no taxes, no penalties are owed on that money. But you have to be very, very, very careful of one important thing. Do you know what that is? Make sure the 401k accepts rollovers.
Well, you already said it did, though.
Well, that was the hypothetical 401k you made.
I didn't realize you jumped to a new hypothetical.
Well, if people are working for a company that has a 401k.
May not accept rollovers. So I wouldn't take the money out until you're sure it has a place to go in.
Not all 401ks will accept rollovers. Remember I said if you're a solo practitioner, you're allowed to open what is known as a solo 401k. What is that? A one-person 401k. That's all a solo 401k is. It is for self-employed people. It is for what we would call consultants or realtors. You don't want any employees. No employees. You have an employee, this whole thing blows up. But a solo 401k is a very inexpensive, simple 401k for self-employed people. And you just allow your 401k to accept rollovers. Now, if you work for a company and you have a 401k and you're thinking, God, I really need this short-term loan. I'm going to take money from my IRA because I heard this guy on the radio say it's exempt from the one per year rule. And I've already done a rollover in January and I can't do another one. Well, you could take money from your IRA, do what you want with it for 60 days, and put it back into a 401k. But before you do that, folks, make sure you call the 401k and say, hey, do you guys accept rollovers? I'm going to take money from my IRA, and I want to send you a check. Make sure they know what you're doing, because sometimes you're just talking to some guy answering the phone. Rollover and transfer are often used interchangeably and cause confusion. A transfer is when you go directly from the 401k to the IRA or from the IRA to the 401k. You never touch the money. A rollover is where you're touching the money. But there's also a thing that people nickname the direct rollover, which is where you take money from an IRA directly to a 401k. So if you call the 401k and say, hey, do you guys accept rollovers, make sure they know you're talking about what we call an indirect rollover. The money came to you first, and then you're going to write a check from your checking account to the 401k representing the money that was in your IRA. That's what you want to make sure they accept. Most 401ks will accept direct transfers or direct rollovers. It's this indirect one. You want to make sure they accept it before you try taking money out of your IRA.
Good idea. But don't start to juggle with knives until you're sure you want to take that risk.
Yes.
Because the penalties are fairly severe if you mess this up.
Exactly. And this applies whether you're going from a 401k to an IRA or an IRA to a 401k. Now, you would never want to do a rollover from a 401k to an IRA for one simple reason. The government mandates when you take cash out of a 401k and roll it over, an indirect rollover. You take the money, do what you want with it for 60 days, and then get it into an IRA. When you do that from a 401k to an IRA, the 401k people will withhold 20% of the money you wanted and send it to the IRS. Because the IRS takes the assumption you are not going to complete the rollover, and they want their taxes, because they're going to tax you if you don't get it into an IRA within 60 days. And here's where insult comes, is added to injury, or whatever that saying is. So let's say you ask for $10,000. You're only going to get $8,000. But you have to get $10,000 back into an IRA within 60 days, or you're going to owe taxes on the difference. So we never, ever, ever recommend you try a rollover from a 401k to an IRA. From an IRA to a 401k, no problem. The 20% automatic withholding does not apply for money coming out of an IRA, only money coming out of a 401k. Here's another one that is exempt, the canceled first-time home purchase exemption.
The canceled first-time homeowner's exemption.
Yep.
What do you mean it canceled?
There, excuse me. You are allowed to take money from an IRA mm-hmm. or a Roth IRA. If you take it from a Roth IRA, mm-hmm. it's tax-free, of course. If you take it from an IRA, you'll be taxable. You'll be taxed on it. But you are exempt from the 10% penalty, Chris, if you take up to $10,000 of money out of your IRA and use it for a first-time home purchase.
Right, and that we've talked about before.
Yes.
That's good. Has that been canceled, or no. you take the money out canceled. And the closing gets canceled, closing so you got to put canceled. The money back?
Yes. Ah. You have 120 days. In this unique case, the time period isn't 60 days. You have 120 days to close on the house. You have to close within 120 days of taking money out of your IRA. But sometimes, Chris, closings don't happen.
True.
And they go under. You are allowed, if you've had money out of your IRA and it's been sitting in the bank and you want to use it to cover closing costs, remember, if it's coming from a traditional IRA, you still have to pay taxes on it. You just won't pay a 10% penalty. That's why some people use it to buy a first-time home. Now the closing fell through, the IRS says you have additional time from the 120 days to get the money in if the money was, if the closing never went through.
So then you could try it again.
Yes, later.
Find another house or the closing gets back on or something like that.
And the final one, which a lot of people may not know because hopefully it's not used often. I really hope this isn't used often because it does involve the death of a military person. But the government allowed, after they passed the HEART Act in 2008, they love acronyms. Mm-hmm. So the HEART Act stands for Heroes Earnings Assistance and Relief Tax, HEART. But it's not really a tax, but they had to get the word heart in there mm-hmm. because they...
So those would be here.
Yeah, they would have been here. Yeah, I don't know why they call it the HEAR Act, but they wanted the HOT Act. Oh. So the Heroes Earnings Assistant and Relief Tax, passed in 2008, June 17, 2008, contains a unique provision. It allows anybody receiving a benefit due to the death of a military person. So if you're receiving a military death gratuity or the service members group life insurance, otherwise known as SGLI, you can take that death benefit and put it into an IRA, a Roth IRA, excuse me, 100% tax-free.
Hmm.
Again, it's an awful lot of money because these can be very large policies.
Mm-hmm.
Does not count towards your contribution. Does not count against the one-per-year rollover rule.
Hmm.
So you could take the death benefit from the death of a military member from their SGLI, Service Members Group Life, or any type of military payment for a death gratuity, and put that in a Roth IRA. Whether you're the spouse or not, you can put it in the Roth IRA. Hmm.
Interesting. That's one I didn't know. So when we come back, we'll hear some more of these. Also, when we come back from this next break, we're going to hear the number one song this week from 1976. This song is considered Paul McCartney's most successful post-Beatle hit. So we'll hear what that is here right after this short break.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. We are listening to the number one song from 1976, this week in 1976 at least. I let the cat out of the bag already in the before the break that this is Paul McCartney. Fairly obvious for anybody who knows any Beatle voices. What's the name of the song, Jim?
Silly Love Songs.
It is, in fact, Silly Love Songs. Trading places this week with last week's Diana Ross song, Love Hangover, is Silly Love Songs. So, Silly Love Songs.
And that's back into the number one then, because it was number one a couple weeks ago when you weren't here.
Silly Love Songs was?
Yes.
Oh, so it's bouncing back and forth. This song was voted the hottest number one song for 1976 year overall.
Hmm. I was there, I remember.
In 1976, you were there?
I was alive in 76.
I was too.
You were too? Wow.
I was also.
I was three.
Yeah, whatever. You were driving by 1976.
63, 73. No, I was not. I wasn't even eligible for a learner's permit yet.
Okay.
I went far away, yeah. But I wasn't eligible for one.
So, oh yeah, we're talking about IRAs and tax issues. I was thinking we have to come up with a topic, but we already have a topic. It's top IRA tax mistakes.
Yeah, but what'd you have to come up with a topic for?
I thought we had finished that one, but there's even more mistakes to be listed.
Oh, yeah, I got plenty. I got enough to do the rest of the show.
I hope so, because we have two more segments.
Good. Another mistake is, do you know what?
Year
of death required minimum distribution.
Oh, this is a hot one. This is a big one.
This one causes a lot of trouble with tax preparers.
Yep.
So we talked about mistakes. These are really mistakes that tax preparers are making. So we talked about earlier about in the last segment, the once per year rule on rollovers when the clock begins ticking. Mistakes with Form 5329, least of which is just zero it out and file it. But there's another mistake, year of death RMD, and this still to this day causes confusion in the tax preparing community.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the IRS issued a revenue ruling in 2005. It's revenue ruling 2005-36. Came out June 27th, 2005. What does a revenue ruling mean, Chris?
It's the IRS announcing to everyone that this is how everyone will be treated and this is how the rules are to work for everyone.
Right. And I will summarize revenue ruling with 12 words.
12 words. Okay, I'm going to count.
The year of death RMD must be taken by the beneficiary.
You're counting RMD as one word?
Yes.
Okay.
What'd you get, 14?
Well, I got to 12 if I counted RMD as one word.
RMD is one word.
Mm-hmm. Say that once again, because that's pretty clear.
You can't get any clearer than that.
12 words sums it up.
The year of death RMD must be taken by the beneficiary.
Unless it's already been taken by the dead person.
Correct.
Right.
Well, that would make it more than 12 words.
Well, that's the rest of the story.
But all too often, tax preparers want to put it on the decedent's final return or the decedent's final 1041. It's called the 1041.
Or pay it into their estate and then pay it to the estate.
Exactly. It doesn't. Remember something, people. The second an IRA owner dies, the owner of that account is now the named beneficiary. Case closed.
Technically, no, but...
Okay.
The recipient of all benefits of that IRA becomes the new person. But remember, there's that whole rule, and this comes with protecting an inherited IRA from creditors and that sort of thing. It's deemed that the person receiving it isn't, in fact, the owner of that. That's not their IRA. So technically,
they are not the owner. The dead guy is still the owner. They are the beneficiary of the IRA.
But the moment, the exact moment
the money
of the
belongs
death,
to...
The beneficiary is the recipient of all the proceeds of that account from that moment forward. It doesn't flow through an estate or flow through probate or flow anywhere else. The moment that death occurs, the named beneficiary becomes the recipient of all future distributions, even if there's a missed RMD or any other monies that come out of there. So that's... I guess we're going to be technically correct because I know we do have some people in the business, if you would say, that listen to the show, and sometimes they'll send me a little email of, well, technically, blah 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 blah. So I wanted to prevent that email from coming.
You've been corrected? Because I got corrected by my English, or lack thereof.
No, they're correcting you, but they send it to me just because I'm the keeper of all things straight and truthful.
Oh, I didn't know I was corrected. Mm-hmm. Why don't you let me know when someone dares correct me?
You have a very fragile ego, and I.
Well, that's why we play the disclaimer.
True.
I don't know what we're talking about.
Yeah. Make sure you consult with somebody else before you do anything.
Well, I mean, legally we have to play. It's sad, but nowadays you have to play those types of disclaimers.
True.
But I do know what I'm talking about here. There's no ifs, ands, and buts about it. The required minimum. That wasn't a big but.
You said there's no ifs, ands, or buts.
Well, I didn't. Every time I say but, you don't have to. You don't have to play Sir Mix-a-Lot. No. I was just using him in the last case. I'd love to be in tax court with the Barbro case when the first part of the ruling was, Mr. Barbro, you win. IRS, you lose. He had to have been so ecstatic, And I just assume the judge or judges went, but. And that was a big butt. Okay, you know what we're talking about? Listen to the last segment. To all tax preparers out there, the year of death RMD is not on the decedent's final return, nor does it go on the 1041. It goes on the beneficiary's tax return. Mm-hmm. And that was made adamantly clear by the IRS in 2005 with Revenue Ruling 36. As Chris said, revenue rulings apply to everyone.
As opposed to a private letter ruling, which we talk about sometimes on the show, which is when an individual entity has asked the IRS for guidance on something they want to do, and then the IRS will either say no or will give them the blessing to proceed. But just because the IRS gave them that individual permission to do something doesn't mean they will continue to do so with others. But we do rely on private letter rulings to get some sense of how the IRS will treat such events. So usually we can rely upon them, but technically, it is not the type of announcement that a revenue ruling is, where they're declaring to everyone, this is how everyone will be treated and how everyone should act.
Well put.
Thank you.
Okay.
The caffeine's kicking in.
For those who don't know, Chris is drinking a, what are you drinking?
Some kind of new thingamajigger. A vanilla cream cold brew.
From Starbucks.
Yes. For the first time. They were hand-delivered to us. I like how you have staff in the office now that will bring food and drinks and things like that. That's awesome.
Not only that, we got to order right from our smartphones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And ask Andrew to please go pick up our coffee. Mm-hmm.
Did you buy him a coffee at least for going to get it?
Nope. Bought him a tea.
Oh, well, something.
Yeah, he wanted, he got a really unique thing I had never heard of. Another new one from Starbucks. We'll do a little Starbucks commercial here. He got, whoops, just got rid of what? Well, I can't tell you what he got because my app just went kaflooky.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure everyone's waiting to hear what we ordered.
I got it.
Starbucks.
A Grande London Fog Tea Latte.
Hmm.
Never even heard of that.
It'll be like a chai latte, but it's London Fog Tea instead of chai tea.
Grande London Fog Tea Latte. 180 calories for him. Yours was 110.
Mm-hmm.
Mine, being decaf, skim milk, sugar-free syrup, just 90.
90. Mm-hmm. But you eat you drink 12 a day, so.
I went to decaf.
This is my one and only.
Has it shown?
The decaf part?
Much calmer. What was that face for? I bet you listeners are going to be emailing us all the time now. Yes, we've noticed, Jim. You are much more calmer on the show.
Whatever. I don't think so. I don't think there's any difference on the show.
I've been decaf for 2 weeks, 2 months now. No headaches, no nothing. And
there's caffeine in that Coke Zero you were drinking.
Yeah, that's the only thing. But notice it's the little mini can, the little 8-ounce can. And when these cans are gone, because I didn't want to waste them, they have little mini caffeine-free Diet Cokes. And that's what I'll be drinking.
Excellent.
But ruled out caffeine. I started adding up all the caffeine from the copious amounts of coffee I consume. It was quite a bit of damn caffeine.
It was. Did you divulge that to your physician? Or do you have, can we do a HIPAA thing here? And
when I see him in October, I usually go for my physical then. I will let him know I cut out caffeine. Because I was having
I think your heart
anxiety,
your,
flutter
blood pressure
things.
Be down. Doesn't
my
caffeine?
Blood pressure is always down. I never had high blood pressure.
Oh, even on all that caffeine?
Oh, yeah. Never had high blood pressure. Hmm. Just get these anxiety feelings and everything. I get worried about the business and work and what are we doing. And I was just freaking out.
The gray hair was
times.
Coming. And
yeah, I was looking in the mirror the other day. There's like four that I've seen now. The gray hairs are coming in.
Okay.
But I went decaf, people. It is not as hard as you think. And decaf doesn't, I mean, we're not talking Sanka. We're not talking that junk. But real good decaf. Starbucks decaf, Pete's coffee and tea decaf, a good decaf. I can't tell the difference in taste. And I'm realizing now I crave the taste more than the caffeine. Mm. I like strong black coffee. That's how I drink it. Mm-hmm. Now, this is iced because it's summer. But in the morning, it's strong black coffee. At night, strong black coffee. And the stronger, the better. I could sit there and just drink a shot of espresso. No problem. So that's what I like. It's the taste I crave. Decaf hasn't been bad. You can get good. Now, there's awful decaf out there, but you can find it.
Well, I'm glad you found your way.
I did. Okay.
Next tax issue.
RMD aggregation issues.
Aggregation. That's a big word,
Jim. That's a big
word,
and I pronounced it quite well. Because there's no M or N in that word.
Huh. So you couldn't pronounce like conflagration or something like that?
I don't even think that's a word, so I'm not even going to try.
It's a word.
Conflagration is a word.
Pretty sure.
What does it mean?
I have no idea, but I've heard it before.
You just made that up.
No, I'll Google it. I'll read you the... You continue on and I'll...
Wait a minute. Use it in a sentence if you heard it before. Stop looking it up. Use it in a sentence.
No, I've
See,
never
you
heard.
Don't. You made
I've never
that
heard
word
it in
up.
A sentence. No, it's a word. Conflagration, an extensive fire that destroys a great deal of land or property. Quote: the conflagration spread rapidly through the wooden buildings.
There's no M and N in that word.
There's two N's in there,
but not together. You put an M and an N together.
So
that's
you can
what,
say conflagration.
Conflagration.
Well, that's pretty good. Okay, move on to your. Aggregation of RMDs.
was just tightening up my microphone. It was loose. Okay, so another mistake that tax preparers make all the time, folks, and even people, RMD aggregation issues. Here's where it gets confusing. Remember, what is a required minimum distribution? That's what we call RMD. An RMD is a rule that the government put in place that if you were still alive after the age of 70 and a half, specifically April 1st of the year following the year you turned 70 and a half, but in the year you turn 70 and a half, you have to begin taking money from your IRA or other retirement account, except Roth IRAs. They have no required minimum distribution rule. The government begins the distribution at about 3.7% is what you have to take out. And then every year that percentage amount goes up. The actual dollar amount withdrawn may actually decrease, even though the percentage amount of the account you have to take out increases, and that's if the overall value of your retirement account is dropping. Let's say the market took it away, or you took some out, and the IRA is just not as big as it once was. Even though you're taking out more every year as a percentage of your account, your actual RMDs may drop. Conversely, your actual RMDs may rise. Remember, the first RMD is about 3.7% of your account. So if your account earns more than that, your required minimum distribution next year could even be larger than it was the year before. So RMDs can get a little bit confusing, and one of the most confusing aspects of RMDs is how do you handle multiple accounts? That's what the IRS calls aggregation rules. And they allow certain accounts to be aggregated, Chris. IRAs can be aggregated and 403Bs can be aggregated. And what does aggregation mean? Do you know?
That means putting them all together or averaging them. In when we say something is in aggregate, that means considering all of the things together.
Correct. So let's say you have three $100,000 IRAs.
Congratulations, you have $300,000. That's good news.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And let's say your initial required distribution is your first one, which is 3.7% of your $100,000 account. And remember, it's based on the December 31st value of the previous year. So it doesn't mean it's $100,000 today. It means on December 31st of last year, it was worth $100,000 each one. Mm-hmm. So how much would you have to take out?
Well, you'd have to take out, you've got an RMD of $3,700 per IRA, but you can aggregate IRAs, which means you can take all of the 3,700 times three. You gave me a number that I can't do in my head. I could do it with enough time.
11,400, I bet.
Yeah, that sounds right. No, no.
No?
No. It ends with a 100.
Oh, 10,400.
11,100.
11,100. That was close.
You can take any way you want out of those three. It can all come from one of them. It can be split among two of them. You could spread it out among three in any proportion that you want. All the IRS cares about is that you take $11,100 from what they consider to be your IRA, which includes all of your individual IRA accounts that you might have. So even though you think you have $300,000 IRAs, in the eyes of the IRS, you just have one big $300,000 IRA. And so they don't care where you take the money out of, but it must come from that big old IRA.
Right. So you have three $100,000 IRAs. You have an $11,100 RMD that must be taken by December 31st. The IRS doesn't care if you take $3,700 from each IRA, if you take $11,000 from one and $100 from the other, or if you take all $11,100 from one IRA. They don't care as long as it comes out. Chris, you now have three 401ks, each with $100,000 December 31st value mm-hmm. from the previous year. Your total RMD amount remains
$11,100. $3,700.
How many individual RMDs do you have to take?
You must take at least $3,700 from each 401k. They do not aggregate. They are treated as individual accounts, each with their own RMD. So you, let's say you took $10,000 out of one of them during the year, and you get to the end and you think, well, now I needed to take $11,100. I've only got a little bit more to take. That's not how it works. Anything excess above that $3,700 in that first account that you took out 10,000 in my example, doesn't count as RMDs for any other account. So you are still required to take the 3,700 out of each of those. Minimum. You're always free to take more. They're never going to stop you from taking more. They actually would love for you to take more because you owe more taxes then. So they won't stop you from taking it out. They're just requiring a minimum amount. But there's no aggregation between 401ks nor between 401ks and IRAs.
And then to make this even more confusing, 403Bs, for those teachers in the audience, 403Bs can be aggregated, mm-hmm. but only with other 403Bs, right. Not with IRAs, not with 401Ks. Get the picture, people? This can get really confusing. Do you see why this began with file form 5329 with a bunch of zeros?
Yeah.
Because the tax for missed RMDs is reported on Form 5329. If you're just joining us on the show today, good morning. Go back, not today, but when we post this on iTunes or when we post this on our website, just go to jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Click on the Retirement and IRA Show icon. You'll see right on the home page. Can't miss it. It's got Chris and I's photo on it. Click that on. And listen to today's show. It'll take you to the website. And in about another week or so, the show should hopefully be there. We began this whole discussion with the importance of filing Form 5329 because that's the form you file when you make a mistake. Look at how confusing aggregation rules can be. And Ed said, and again, this is coming from Ed, but he did say a lot of tax preparers are making these types of mistakes. They see money coming from a 401k of $11,100 and think, oh, gee, okay, the person satisfied their RMDs, not knowing that there were three 401ks or one 401k and two IRAs. And even though the total dollar amount necessary came out because of these aggregation rules, you may have to take out more. So if you made a mistake, if you had three 401ks and you said, oh, I got three 401ks, $100,000 in each one as of December 31st of the previous year, I'm in the first year of my RMD, so my amount is 3.7%, and you simply take 300,000, divide it by 3.7%, and see it's $11,100, and you think, oh, no problem here. And you tell your CPA, yeah, I took out $11,100. Doesn't matter. You still have to take $3,700 from IRA, 401k2, and $3,700 for 401k3, even though you took out the correct amount. 401ks cannot be aggregated together or with other types of accounts. Mm-hmm. It gets very confusing, people. And this is why Ed said this is one of the big mistakes tax preparers make when it comes to IRA planning. Do we still have time?
We have about 4 minutes.
Okay. Another mistake. And this one, I am not going to blame tax preparers. So this one, I have to go above the big guy's head. If Ed was here, I would slap him and say,
whoa.
And I'm joking.
I thought you stopped with the caffeine. You're getting very aggressive.
This is not a mistake that I think CPAs should be held liable, or not CPAs, but tax preparers should be held liable for, because I don't really think it's something that is really their responsibility.
Really?
Well, you tell me what you think.
Mm-hmm.
Properly updating IRA beneficiary forms.
I don't think that's a realm of the tax planner. That's a retirement planning activity. And something either a person on their own or if they're working with a retirement planner should be keeping up on. Because it really has to do with who's going to receive the IRA upon your death, which is, again, a legacy planning or estate planning issue. Has nothing to do with taxes, really. So I guess I'd agree with you. I wouldn't put it in a...
Well, no. Ed,
oh, geez.
I apologize. Now, Chris doesn't because he just threw you under the bus.
What?
He explained.
Did you not give me the whole story?
I didn't read the whole story. I just read the headline.
Thanks a lot.
Now I see how he's putting it on the feet of tax preparers.
Okay, good. What?
Tax preparers should know, or do know, rather. Tax preparers know when family events change, such as marriage, the birth of a child, divorce, death, or remarriage.
Oh, so they should be watching for those
proactive
things and then letting the person know, hey, you might want to update your...
Exactly.
Maybe.
I'll give him that. No. I think someone should, if you're doing taxes, keep losing my voice today. If you're doing taxes and you see your client has been divorced, just got married, had a baby, died, well, not your client, but someone they know died, or remarriage, you should probably tell them you may want to update. You don't have to get into the specifics. Mm-hmm. But I kind of will say, okay, yeah, that makes sense.
That's nice of him. I don't know I'd hold him responsible for it, but that'd be nice of him to do.
Yes,
that.
I will continue to say I don't think it is the responsibility of a tax preparer to bring this up, but I do feel it is a nice thing to do.
If I were a tax preparer, I would do it as one way to set myself apart from other tax preparers who don't take this kind of interest in their clients.
And the reason this is important, people, we've talked on this show plenty of times of 401k inheritances not going to the named beneficiaries. And that's important to understand. We talked about this in blended family situations. It is so important, people, to under... Well, there's the music, so we'll have to do it when we come back. Well, 1 minute. I don't have time to get into this in a minute.
We'll not get into it.
This is like a 5 minute conversation right here.
About updating a beneficiary form?
Absolutely. Okay. How you can lose
because of ERISA. We're going all the way down that path?
Yes, that's what he's getting at.
Okay. Well, that'll be an interesting story once we come back. It's very sad, very enlightening all at the same time. When we come back from this break, we'll be into the last segment of the Retirement and IRA Show. When we come back from this break, we're going to hear the number one song 35 years ago in 1981. This song was a redo of a 1974 song that didn't do too well. They should have left it in 1974, in my opinion. This 1981 version took off and was a huge hit for reasons unknown to me. But we'll find out what that is after this short break on the Retirement and IRA Show.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
Her hair is hollow gold, her lips sweet surprise, her hands are never.
Well, welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. I apologize for having to play that song over and over and over again each week, but it is the number one song from 35 years ago this week in 1981. Hopefully Kim Carnes doesn't listen to the show. Suppose she does. Is Kim Carnes still alive?
I have no idea.
I'll check on that
in
a moment.
I'm sure you will.
But, anyway. Betty Davis Eyes. We don't have to talk about it.
I like
a lot.
The song. I don't know why you don't like that song. I kind of like it.
I don't know. And it sounds to me like she needs to clear her throat before she continues with the song.
I just like
just
that
gravelly.
Raspy voice.
It is raspy and gravelly. There's a little fun fact here. In the song, there's a phrase that she sings. She knows just what it takes to make a pro blush.
Pro blush?
Uh-huh. What a pro, like a professional, something, make them blush. Well, she screwed up the line.
Oh.
The original line from the original song and the way she should have sung it, she was intended. No. It is, she knows just what it takes to make a crow blush.
Crow
which,
blush.
Which is an old phrase.
Crow blush?
Right. You can't make a crow blush.
No, it's black.
Right, exactly. That's the whole point.
And it's got but feathers.
You can embarrass someone so terribly that you could even make a crow blush. That's the concept of it, okay? That's what she should have sung. She sung it, well, to her credit, she cut this song in one take.
Wow, very
Boom.
Good.
There it is. That's what's going out. But she screwed up the line. But then from that point to eternity, she now must sing it incorrectly to match the song as
pro
it was originally. Yeah. So it's Pro Blush in her version. The original song, which was she was trying to replicate, was Crow Blush.
I don't think you could make a swan blush either. It's the feathers.
I don't really try to embarrass a lot of fowl.
It's not the black crow. It's not the black beak.
There's black
it's
swans.
The feathers. There is black swans. Mm-hmm. They found them in Australia.
Mm-hmm. I don't think any of them blush. Or if they do, you need to pick their feathers.
I don't know where you come up with these sayings that I've never heard of. I've never heard of make a crow blush.
I didn't. Tina did.
Tina did, yes. Yeah. That's a fun fact. Yeah. So why do we do all this?
No.
You don't know. Well, I'll tell you, folks, why do we do this? We started with a song from 1935, if you remember. Well, that just so happens to be the first year Social Security was created. We then follow up with the number one song in America 40 years ago. Why do we do that? Simple. When Social Security was first created, to come up with the amount they were going to pay you in benefits, remember, it had never existed before they created it, they came up with a calculation that used something called 40 elapsed years. And they would look back over 40 elapsed years as they determined your benefit amount. But as time went on, especially through the 1950s, that went away and they started looking at what was called 35 computation years. And that's why we ended it with the number one song in America 35 years ago, which was Kim Carnes' Betty Davis Eyes. We do all this, all ties into Social Security. We do all of this because it's a lead-in to our blog. We blog once a week on our blog called helpwithmysocialsecurity.com.
What's new, Pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa. What's new, Pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa.
So this week on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, I've forgotten the title, but I know the subject. So the topic of this week is, what exactly does it take to be considered a spouse and collect spousal benefits? I clarify the rules. And it's a little more complicated than...
Don't you have to
you're
be...
You're married.
Well, you have to be miserable.
Pardon?
You said I'm married, so I said you had to be miserable. It's a single joke. You don't get
it.
Oh,
okay.
Us singles make fun of you married folk.
It's been too long. So, yes, there's... what was I going to say?
I have no idea because I just screwed you all up.
Yes, but anyway, it's a little more complicated than we're married. That is one way. That's the first step in it. You must be married or be in a relationship in a state where that state grants you the same inheritance rights as a married person. So you can see what they're getting at here. Domestic partnerships, civil unions, that in the state. So it's kind of, that's a way where you aren't technically married, but you could qualify as a spouse. But in addition to one or other of those, there's one of three other things that must happen. You have to be married for at least a year, or in this relationship for at least a year, or be the parent of the natural child of your spouse. If that is the case, you don't have to wait the year. So if you have a child, you had a child together before you were married, as soon as you become married, you become eligible for spousal benefits, assuming you're at the right age, you've met the other requirements, etc. Or three, you are entitled to auxiliary benefits like survivor benefits or spousal benefits on another person's record in the month immediately prior to your new marriage. If that's the case, then you immediately qualify for spousal benefits with your new spouse.
Can I ask you a question then?
Certainly.
Because you know, and our listeners don't know, but we're dealing with a case that kind of confused us today, correct? A little bit. But you said the word entitled. Would the for those who don't know, I met with someone earlier this morning, and I knew Chris. Chris is the go-to guy on Social Security in the office, so you will notice that he blogs probably 99.99999% of the time, and I haven't been on the blog in quite some time. But sure. This person was told by Social Security she just remarried and was told by Social Security she's entitled to spousal benefits. Could it be the definition of entitled? You just said if you are entitled. Mm-hmm. What is the difference between entitled and
eligible?
Eligible.
Eligible means you have met most of the requirements or essentially all the requirements so that you could apply for benefits of a certain type. once you've applied and they owe you the money, you are considered entitled.
So you said,
the way the Palms Manual is written, which is the...
Palms is the King James Bible,
King James Bible of how Social Security rules work. They use the word entitled in this spot, which...
Means you were collecting
one of these benefits in the month prior to you getting married to the new person. And my assumption is that they didn't want to make it so that you then gave up any benefits for a year before you could collect again. If you were already collecting, they let you continue to collect under the new spouse.
Okay.
But if you hadn't, if you weren't receiving these benefits, you aren't immediately eligible to file under the new spouse.
Well, this is something that we as an office are going to track this, because when I met with this person this morning and she told me that, oh, I'm going to Social Security next month to file for my spousal benefits, the first thing I said is, you can't. You haven't been married a year. And she said, oh, well, when I went in there to change my name, she had just got married, when I went in there to change my name, she had to go to Social Security first before the DMV would change her name. When I went to Social Security and they asked me what was I there for, I told them, and they said, oh, you're entitled to spousal benefits. And they have an appointment for her next month to turn on her spousal benefits. And I told her, I said, I don't think you can. You haven't been married a year.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't believe she is entitled either, unless there's something else about her record that she didn't share with us that might cause her to be...
Right. So we're following this because I started texting Chris immediately and he's texting me back, and the client was fine with it because I was like, hey, I got to figure this out. And Chris was to the point where she's not entitled to benefits. What we did warn her on, mistakes are often made with people working at Social Security. We've talked about them in the past. Lawrence Kotlikoff, a very, very well-respected national mind on Social Security, wrote the best-selling book on Social Security, someone that Chris is very familiar with and has spoken with many times and teaches at my alma mater, Boston University. Mm-hmm. How's that for a great introduction to Lawrence? But Professor Kotlikoff has said repeatedly one of the biggest beefs he has on Social Security is the bad information they're giving people. Mm-hmm. What I warned this particular person on is, look, if they turn on your benefits and start paying you, but later find out you, in fact, needed to wait a year, even though the mistake was on their end, they're going to demand that money back.
Correct.
So they got to be careful. So we're watching this for her because I can't see how they're giving her benefits. She hasn't been married a year yet.
Correct.
And she wasn't collecting
before, although she was eligible to collect on as a widower benefit on her previously deceased spouse. But she hadn't turned that on yet.
No, so, she was waiting to 66.
So my understanding of the Palms Manual is she doesn't get in under this, I guess, aspect, this extra rule that they put in place to have people continue receiving benefits if they'd started them, not penalizing people just for getting remarried. And but we'll see if maybe they have changed their definition of entitled.
We shall see.
We'll see.
Interesting case.
Yeah.
So anyways, that's what's new on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com.
What's new, pussycat?
Okay. And it's weird. This is a weird coincidence because I had just written this blog post and it posts today.
And I started texting you.
And you texted me about
9:30 this morning.
And see, I when they first got it, I thought he'd read the blog post and was asking me questions about it.
Well, but that's why I put, I'm sitting with a client.
I'm like, wait a minute.
Yeah, no, so, I couldn't reach you on the phone. So I said, do you mind if I text them? Yeah. Because I don't think you can do this.
No, it's weird.
But most of the time where we find mistakes with Social Security, because we've had several people call us to this show, if you remember, as well as people we've been working with who go into Social Security to do one of the recommendations we may make or that we told them they're entitled to, rather. And only to be told by Social Security they can't do it. Only for us to send them back there with, yes, you can, and the proof you can. And we've actually had people who Social Security apologized to for making a mistake. And again, Professor Kotlikoff, who's a well-respected mind on Social Security, knows more than Chris and I combined on Social Security, well-respected man on Social Security, he said one of his biggest pet peeves and biggest beefs is that Social Security reps are not giving proper information. Where it can really come hurt this person is if they give her a benefit she is not entitled to, even though it was their mistake. When they figure it out, they will ask her or demand, not even ask, tell her, you have to give us that money back. So I told her, be very careful if you spend that money. You may have to come up with other monies to make it up. And is there a statute of limitations on a Social Security mistake?
I don't believe so. I actually did blog about this a while back and went through, depending on who makes the mistake, what happens, and what are the exceptions. There are times when you don't have to pay the money back. If you can prove that the money's gone, was spent on eating and living, and you just physically don't have the money back, sometimes they can forgive that and not demand the money back. So there's a lot of details and exceptions on here. I don't believe ever reading about a statute of limitations.
Okay.
So, but I'd have to go back to that and refresh my memory on that blog. I haven't memorized verbatim every single blog post that we've done.
Okay. No problem.
All this new material that keeps coming in starts dropping out the back.
No, that's fine. We've been blogging, or you've been blogging, for almost a year and a half. It'll be almost a year and a half now, once a week. So you've got a lot of blog posts posted and still tons more on Social Security we can write about. So No shortage of topics. Okay, so back to what I was trying to explain in the previous segment. It's not necessarily a responsibility of a tax preparer to monitor and look at the beneficiary forms of people. But I feel it is a responsibility of a tax preparer to simply say to a person, if you see that your client has remarried, divorced, had a new child, had a death in the family or a close death in the family, or remarried, any of these, that tax preparer should recommend to the person to update their or at least review their beneficiary form, because the beneficiary form is how you leave an inherited retirement account to someone. Retirement accounts, IRAs, 401ks, 403bs, 457s, TSPs, all these accounts pass by right of law. Not what's in your will, but by right of law. In other words, whoever is listed on the beneficiary form will be the ones to inherit these accounts, or so you would think. And this is the issue Ed was trying to point out. Especially in the case, people, we've talked about this before, in blended family situations and 401ks. 401ks are regulated by a law called ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, ERISA.
And it's monitored and controlled by the Department of Labor.
Yes. ERISA created a whole host of rules to protect spouses.
That's one of the things.
That was one of the big things. Yep. Two things were happening. This passed in 75. Mm-hmm. It also gave birth to IRAs. ERISA is what created IRAs. Back in 75 and prior to that, 74, 73, all throughout the 60s, two things were happening. One, companies were stealing from their pensions. Go figure, right?
Yeah, they were looting them. Rough times. They were looking at that big pot of money that didn't need to be paid to people for maybe 10, 20 years, and borrowing, air quotes,
using it to fund their operational expenses. Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, today that's against the law. Back then it wasn't. They had to pass a law to do that. Mm-hmm. But also back then you were having situations, I don't want to put it all on men, but you were having situations where men were disinheriting their wives from their retirement accounts and naming their floozy lovers off to the side. Maybe I'm being a little facetious there, but there were cases of spouses being disinherited. And then when the spouse dies, the surviving spouse realizes they were disinherited, beneficiary forms were being changed, money was being left to people that the woman didn't even know existed. Mm-hmm. So the government, to change all that, passed very, very strict fiduciary rules, called it ERISA, and that passed in 75. One of the things that people are starting to realize is buried in ERISA, and listeners, pay attention. And tax preparers, pay attention. This is why you need to monitor if your clients divorce, if there's a death, or if there's remarriage. Those, to me, are the three important ones, especially remarriage. Let's just say you have a blended family situation. You have a man and a woman meet, fall in love, and want to get married. Both of them have kids from previous relationships. So after their first divorce, they update the beneficiary forms, which is a good thing to do, on their 401k accounts and name their children as beneficiary.
Right. Because if they leave it, the ex-spouse will get it.
Right. If the name is the ex-spouse and you don't take them off as primary beneficiary, this has been adjudicated many times and the tax court says, sorry, ex-spouse or not, they're the primary beneficiary, they're getting it.
Yep.
So one of the first things most divorce attorneys probably tell their clients is, now that this is finalized and done, update your beneficiary forms.
Yep.
And most times the people will name their children, which is what they want. And then most times, not all, but most times in a blended family situation, these people are now divorced, they go through their healing process, and 2 weeks later they're out dating again. Maybe 2 years, but could be as little as 2 weeks. And they fall in love yet again. And they think, I was wrong once, but this time is for real. I'm going to do it again. Yep. I'm going to get married. Most of the time, those people will say to each other, hey, what's mine is going to go to my kids. What's yours goes to your kids. After our marriage, what's ours, we'll have a will and we'll put a estate plan in place to take care of our stuff. And that's how most people approach it. Okay, my stuff goes to my kids. Your stuff goes to your kids. Our stuff goes to each other. And then we'll divvy it up when the last one of us passes away. That's usually how it's done. It's not how it's done with ERISA. And therein lies the problem, folks. Because ERISA says, by law, irrespective of who is named on the beneficiary form, remember, they were addressing the disinheritance of spouses. So they said, irrespective of who is on the beneficiary form, within a period of time no greater than 1 year, the mandatory beneficiary of all ERISA-protected accounts, and 401ks are one of them, will be the spouse.
Period.
Now, they put the longest it will take, 1 year. All 401ks have the ability to shorten that. They can't lengthen it. They can't say, it's 5 years before the spouse gets it. They can say it's 1 day. They can say it's immediate. They can say it's 6 months. They just can't say a period of time more than 1 year.
And that will appear in what's called the master plan document, which details all of these little things in there. So your specific 401k, you can discover for yourself what their rule is in that master plan document that must be made available to you by your 401k administrator.
Correct. And it can be no more than 1 year. And there's where the rub lies. Because no one is telling people this. We are, but no one else is. And the issue is, you think everything is hunky-dory. You got divorced. You have your own kids. After the divorce, you named your own children as beneficiary. A couple of years later, or however long later, you're in love again. You're thinking of getting married. You're sitting around. You're not going to make the mistakes anymore. So you're talking and you're saying, look, what's mine is mine. My children are named as beneficiary of my 401k. What's yours is yours. Your children is named as beneficiary of the 401k. Let's leave it like that. We're fine. And they go off and get married. And they still think it's fine.
Because they haven't changed their forms, their beneficiary
forms. Everything's
fine.
The beneficiaries are the kids. What's the worry? The worry is, in a period of time no greater than 1 year, and it could be a lot shorter. We've talked about court cases on this show where it was immediate and someone died 6 weeks after marriage and the kids got disinherited. That's what happens, people.
The spouse becomes the spouse, only beneficiary.
Right, becomes the default beneficiary, and it does not matter who is on your beneficiary form. What you need to do, and this is why Ed is saying tax preparers see this ahead of time. What you need to do is tell them, hey, you're remarrying? Revisit your beneficiary forms. Talk to your spouse. Talk to your financial advisor. Talk to your 401k provider. And then the proper way to do it, or not the proper, the only way to do it is to then get a spousal waiver form from the 401k. And the courts have ruled it has to be that 401k's spousal waiver form. Making up your own doesn't work. You contact the 401k and you say, I need the spousal waiver form. And that new spouse of yours has to sign that form that simply says, I hereby waive my ERISA-protected rights to my new spouse's 401k. Without that signed, your inheritance is going to go to your spouse.
Exactly. And that form cannot be signed as part of a prenuptial arrangement of any kind, because only a spouse can sign a spousal waiver, and they're not your spouse until you get married. And here's another little rub. You could get married thinking they're going to sign it, and then they just have to say no, and they become then the beneficiary, and there's nothing you can do about it.
You could divorce them.
You could divorce them.
Immediately.
Guess, yeah,
right. I'm out of here.
Yeah,
but no, this is important, people, and that's why we were trying to mention it to you today. These are all common mistakes. Unfortunately, they're common. They shouldn't be common. They're easy ways to protect yourself. Form 5329, very easy way to protect yourself. Spousal waiver forms, protect that 401k after remarriage. RMD aggregation rules, don't get burned by that. And then, of course, the second one that we talked about, year of death required minimum distributions. Know how those are done. And then finally, know the rules on one-year rollovers. These are mistakes that are made that shouldn't happen.
Yep. So we find ourselves once again at the end of a episode of the Retirement and IRA Show. Please contact us at jimhelps.com. That's jimhelps.com if you have any questions. We will be back with you next week.
We'll be back next week, and you can give us a call if you ever have any questions, or send us an email, and we will meet with you.
Perfect. So we'll see everybody next week.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Like what you just heard? Missed some of today's show? Listen again on iTunes or the Retirement and IRA Show.com.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.